Go ahead and open your Bibles to Esther chapter 5. Esther chapter 5. In 586 BC, the Jews in Judea were conquered by the Babylonians and they entered into exile. A few decades later, Babylon was conquered by Persia, and King Cyrus allowed the Jews to begin to return to their homeland and rebuild. The book of Ezra documents the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem. The book of Nehemiah documents the building of the walls of Jerusalem. But the book of Esther is about the Jews who stayed behind in Persia. The setting for this book is over 100 years after the Jews had entered into captivity. So life in a foreign land was the only life that these Jews had known. Esther might be most well known for what it does not contain, because God's name is never mentioned in this entire book. And I'm thankful for books of the Bible where the activity of God is obvious and his power is on full display. And I'm thankful for the book of Esther, where God's activity is veiled, because I just think that's highly relatable. I think that's the way we feel about God's activity in our lives so often as well. We struggle with the invisibility of God. We struggle to understand what he is up to. We want to hear his voice. We want his plan and his working to be more obvious. And the great thing about the way Esther is written is that by not mentioning God, it encourages us as readers to look for him. And as we do, we discover that he is everywhere in this book. He is working even in the tiny details, just as he is working in the details of our lives. So our purpose for this series is that we would trust and see the hidden hand of God. Don't you want that in your life? You want to trust what he's doing, and you want to see what you've been missing. You want to see his activity more and more. You want to see his hidden hand at work. Last week, Pastor John, in chapters 3 and 4, introduced us to the villain of this story, Wicked Haman. Boo! If you remember, his anger was kindled because Mordecai, who was one of those Jewish exiles, refused to bow down to him when Haman was walking past the king's gate. And so Haman gets the king's permission to wipe out all of the Jews in all 127 provinces of Persia, which seems like a slight overreaction to that offense. Right? Wouldn't you agree? Just a little bit over the top. I have a child or two that has been known to overreact to certain situations daily, all the time, and even they might tell Haman that he needs to take a deep breath or two. Right? I think my kids would read this and be like, I don't know if this reaction is justified. It seems like a lot, wiping out the entire Jewish population in Persia. But the author of Esther makes sure to emphasize that this is not just a random conflict between two individuals. As Pastor John talked about last week, Haman was an Amalekite. And the conflict between the Jews and the Amalekites goes all the way back to Jacob and Esau. This is the same group of people that attacked the Israelites as they were leaving Egypt in Exodus. King Saul was instructed to wipe out the Amalekites completely, but had failed to do so. And now Haman is trying to wipe out all the Jews from Persia. And throughout this book, there's all sorts of what are the odds moments. What are the odds that a Jewish orphan in Persia would become queen of all the land? What are the odds that while she is queen, the king would be convinced to make a royal decree that will allow all the Jews to be killed by their neighbors? What are the odds of that? They are really, really good in the providence of God. And we're going to see through these next two chapters God's sovereign hand over the sequences of our lives. God's sovereignty over the sequences of events. So at the end of chapter 4, we are left with a city that is in mourning. Mordecai is in sackcloth and ashes and communicating with Esther that she needs to do something about this. She needs to speak with the king and reveal her ethnicity and try to save her people. But there's a problem. And that problem is that Esther isn't supposed to approach the king unannounced. Right? She's not just supposed to come without an invitation, and the penalty for coming before the king unannounced is death unless he extends his golden scepter, which again just sounds totally reasonable. Right? Just punishment totally fits that crime right there. Not an overreaction at all. And so Mordecai doesn't believe it's a coincidence that Esther is in this elevated position at this moment. He says to Esther, "Who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" And despite Esther's trepidation, she asks for all the Jews to fast on her behalf, and she commits to going before the king saying, "If I die, I die." And that doesn't fit with the personality of Esther that we've been shown in the beginning of this book. Prior to that, the author has emphasized her compliance and just how she's always gone along, and as opposed to Queen Vashti, who is this defiant queen, her compliance has always been emphasized to this point. But now, for the sake of her people, she's going to step outside of what is comfortable and what is safe. And that is where chapter 5 picks up the story. The first 4 chapters of the book of Esther cover about 9 years of time. And the next 3 chapters are going to cover about 36 hours. So things are about to slow down a lot in this narrative. And we're going to jump in Esther chapter 5 and verse 1. On the third day, that's the third day of all the Jews in Persia fasting on Esther's behalf. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, in front of the king's quarters, while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight, and he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter, and the king said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you, even to half of my kingdom." And Esther said, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared for the king." Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, so that we may do as Esther has asked." So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. In the sequence of events here, we see Esther go from fasting to feasting. Esther, in this narrative, is torn between two worlds. Outside the palace, you have confusion and mourning and sackcloth and ashes, especially for her Jewish people. And then inside the palace, you have this constant flow of alcohol and food and luxury, this elite class of people that seems to be entirely disconnected from the real world around them. And so on the third day of the people fasting for her, Esther puts on royalty and she enters into the inner court without an invitation. And can I just stop here for a moment and say that I am so thankful that our approach to the King of Kings doesn't have to be with fear for our lives. Even though that's what we deserve. In fact, we don't deserve access to God's holy presence at all because of our sin. The entire setup of the temple in Jerusalem was meant to reinforce that truth, that because of your sin, you can't come in. Access to God's presence was always guarded, but because of Jesus, our great high priest, he has made the sufficient for all sacrifice for our sin, and now we have an open invitation to come boldly before the throne of grace. God's presence is not where we experience rejection and shame. His presence is where we experience mercy and find grace to help in our time of need. We are not at the mercy of a temperamental king's whims or feelings. We are at the mercy of the unchanging sovereign king of the universe. And for his children, there is no safer place to be. And Esther probably did not feel any of that in this moment. She probably did not feel very safe as she went before King Xerxes. But the tension in the narrative is quickly broken. And you can almost just imagine the soundtrack of the movie changing as the king extends the golden scepter to his queen and she touches the tip of it and her life is spared for now. And the king knows that Esther would not have come into his presence unannounced unless she has a significant request. And he preemptively promises up to half of his kingdom. And part of you just wants Esther to go for it right there, right? Like, just tell him, half your kingdom, Esther, go for it. Let's do this. But she waits. And she invites him and Haman to a feast instead because she knows her man is always up for a party, right? Always up for a good meal. And he immediately accepts, and we pick it up in verse 6. And as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, "What is your wish? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled." Then Esther answered, "My wish and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them tomorrow, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." As much as King Xerxes enjoyed a good dinner, he was insightful enough to know that Esther hadn't risked her life just for a date, right? He knows that can't be the reason that she came into the court that day. So he once again, at this meal, tries to get her to share her request. And he once again preemptively promises half his kingdom to a Jewish woman that he had decreed could be killed in a few months without realizing it. Right? Just how he feels about Esther and the decree that he has made, they just don't go together. And we don't know if Esther just doesn't have the courage in this moment. The author sort of builds it up like she's about to share what she needs, and then she stops and asks him to come back tomorrow. But I think it's more likely that she had this planned out this way. She really wanted to set herself up for success. She knows it's really hard to ask for the reversal of an irreversible decree. And so she's patient in this moment. She is meek. We see her humility. And she kindly asks for the king and Haman to dine with her again tomorrow, where she promised to share her request. And if you are the king, you are really intrigued at this point, aren't you? Like, what in the world could this possibly be? She had him right where she wanted him. He's just so eager to know what she wants. And ladies, if your man ever complains that you are not telling him what is on your mind, maybe suggest he take you on a second date. Just see what happens, and you will tell him then. So the focus of this narrative switches now to Haman as he is leaving this feast. And Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart, but when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh, and Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced above him above all the officials and the servants of the king. Then Haman said, "Even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. Yet all of this is worth nothing to me as long as I see Mordecai sitting at the king's gate." Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows 50 cubits high be made. And in the morning, tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then joyfully go with the king to the feast." This idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. Haman leaves the party just on top of the world. He is so important that he was the only person invited to this private meal with the king and the queen, and he gets to come back for the same thing tomorrow. But then he sees Mordecai sitting around, not standing in respect or kneeling in fear, just the audacity of Mordecai just to be sitting at the king's gate, and Haman's entire night is completely ruined. He has to restrain himself. Like, it's almost like he just wants to go punch him in the face. He has to restrain himself from taking it out on him right then and there. And he goes back to the house, and he gets his wife and his friends together just so he can tell them how great he is. All right, just imagine that. My guess is that these friends had heard these stories a couple times before. Wouldn't you guess that? They probably heard him talk about how great he is a few times before. And you have to feel for Haman's wife, in my opinion. This guy does not sound very fun to be married to. Yes, dear, I know how many sons we have. I know. You're right. You're very rich. You're very important. I know. So they listen to him drone on about how awesome he is and how he got to go to this exclusive dinner with the king and the queen. And then he gets to the kicker. None of it matters, right? All of it means nothing to me as long as Mordecai is sitting at the king's gate. And at this point, Haman's wife and friends were probably trying to think of any solution that would keep them from having to listen to Haman's complaining again. So they suggest, "How about you just kill him?" Right? It seems like the easiest solution to us. "How about you just kill him tomorrow? You're powerful. The king's a pushover. Mordecai's a nobody. This shouldn't be a big deal." And either Mordecai is much taller than we realize, or the 50-cubit gallows was a little bit over the top. Just have a 50-cubit gallows made. And I think we are intended in chapter 5 to see the contrast between the humility of Queen Esther and the pride of Haman. Haman didn't just crave significance. He craved being seen as significant. So it wasn't enough for him to have riches and to have power and position. He needed his power and position to be recognized. His idol was public recognition. Public recognition. And I always want to make sure to point out idolatry, because it is a sinful struggle for all of us, and it is deadly. Idolatry is deadly. And an idol is anything that we value more than God. Anything that we love more than God, anything that we prioritize over him. And I know our natural instinct is to try to distance ourselves from the villain of a story, but being driven by a need for public recognition is not unique to Haman. That is not unique to him. We all naturally enjoy getting credit for what we do. In fact, one thing I'm learning one of the difficult dynamics of parenting four children is that when I give one of them a compliment, I'm suddenly expected to give three more to the others that I have not yet given a compliment to. So we'll be in a situation, I'll be like, "You did such a great job at your school today. You did such a great job cleaning up." And what's the very next thing I hear? "Well, what about me? What about me? Didn't I do a good job? Haven't you noticed what I've been doing, Daddy?" If we're honest, I'm not sure if we ever really grow out of this. I'm pretty sure what about me is hardwired into all of us as sinful human beings. This was Haman's idol. He valued it more than anything else. And maybe this is your struggle as well. Your day can be ruined if someone doesn't give you the credit that you deserve. If they don't recognize how awesome you are, or how great of a job you did, or how great your social media post is. And God has a way of exposing our idols and our pride, and we're going to see that in dramatic fashion in chapter 6. But here we have this contrast between the humility and selflessness of Esther and the pride and selfishness of Haman. And the frustrating part about the story to this point, and the frustrating part of maybe your story, is that it feels like pride is winning. It feels like pride is going to win. Because we have a scheduling conflict for this next day. The day Haman plans to kill Mordecai is the same day Esther is trying to save him. And if we forget about how this story ends for a moment, and just place yourself in at the end of Esther chapter 5. Just set yourself right there. You just know the first 5 chapters. You have no idea what happens next. You're hearing this account for the first time. There is so much tension right here between Esther 5 and 6. Because Esther's second feast isn't coming until the evening. And Haman is planning to hang Mordecai first thing in the morning. And all he has to do is convince the king, who he has already pushed over and convinced to wipe out an entire people group. Why would the king care what happens to Mordecai? He has no idea that Esther is Jewish, let alone related to him. He doesn't remember that Mordecai saved his life those years ago. And then the second guessing starts. Why didn't Esther just ask the king when he first held out the golden scepter? Why didn't she take him up on his offer at the first feast? This could have all been avoided. What is she waiting for? And she thought she had this all planned out, but now her patience is going to be punished, and hasty Haman is going to ruin everything. And all this tension sets up, in my opinion, one of the funniest scenes in all of the Bible. Esther chapter 6. On that night, the king could not sleep. He really wanted to know what the queen wanted. Couldn't even sleep. Maybe that's not the reason, but he could not sleep. And he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, "What honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" The king's young men who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." And the king said, "Who's in the court?" Now Haman just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, "Haman is there standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So it just so happens that the king can't sleep the night before all of this is about to go down. And I'm not sure what you usually do when you can't sleep, but it just so happens, as luck would have it, that he decides to have someone read to him about the memorable deeds that have happened in his kingdom. And it just so happens, you know, by random chance, that Mordecai's name comes up. And the king is reminded that there was a Jewish man who uncovered an assassination attempt and saved his life, and nothing has been done to thank him. And it just so happens, you know, just a complete fluke, that Haman shows up right then to ask the king if he can kill the man that saved the king's life. This is going to be an awkward conversation. Right? This is going to be an awkward sequence of events right here, because it just so happens all the time because God is sovereign in the sequences. And of course, the king can't make a decision for himself, so he has to ask Haman what to do, because he always has to ask somebody what to do. And now we just get to sit back and enjoy the sovereignty of God. This is great. So Haman came in, and the king said to him, "What should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor?" And Haman said to himself, "Whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" Oh, Haman. Pastor John tried to make us feel bad for Haman last week, and maybe this is just my flesh talking, but I don't feel bad for him at all in this moment, not a bit. And if you ever want an example of how pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall, here you go, verse 7. And Haman said to the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn." Game-worn robes, folks, which the king has worn. "And the horse that the king has ridden," a game-worn horse, "and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. And let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor. And let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" Then the king said to Haman, "Hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai, the Jew who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned." I wish the Bible tells us what Haman's face looked like right at this moment. How low was his jaw? So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." Awesome, right? I mean, is there a better sequence of events in all of the Bible? Part of the joy for us as readers is that we know more of the context from the outside looking in than the individuals in the story know. Haman had no idea the king wanted to honor Mordecai. Neither the king nor Haman know that the queen is Jewish. The king had no idea that Haman showed up to get permission to hang Mordecai on the gallows. The king still doesn't seem to realize that he has given a death sentence to all the Jews, which includes his queen. And Mordecai is being paraded around the city like a king. He's in a game-worn robe, having no idea that his day almost ended very differently if it weren't for the hidden hand of God. And it's nearly impossible not to take pleasure in Haman's idol causing his demise. A man who values public recognition more than anything else, and now he thinks this is his chance to receive the royal treatment that he deserves, to be paraded around like a king, and for the whole city to see how important and how valuable he is, and then to get to go to another feast with the king and the queen. This is about to be Haman's best day ever, right? This is all his hopes and dreams coming true, but instead of him getting his idol, his royal fantasy is given to his arch nemesis instead. And I wish we could have seen the look on Haman's face when Xerxes told him to do all of that for Mordecai. He has to put the robes on Mordecai himself. How awkward must that have been? And because God has a sense of humor, Haman is forced to honor the man who refused to honor him. Haman's fantasy of being publicly celebrated turned into the reality of him being publicly humiliated. And the author just leaves us to guess at Mordecai's feelings through all of this, but my guess is he probably felt pretty uncomfortable in this moment. Haman described what would be his fantasy for a day. He did not describe Mordecai's. My guess is this was not Mordecai's favorite day, right? He just probably felt like he was playing dress up. And this is not the reward that he would have chosen for himself. But it was far better than the day that he could have had. And even greater things are still in store. And the chapter ends with us getting to feel bad for Haman's wife and friends once again. Verse 12. Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate. He just goes back to where he was before. Dress up is over. He's back at the king's gate. But Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him." While they were yet talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. So the same group has to listen to Haman pout again, only this time they start to catch on that there is something greater at work here. Which is interesting, right? This is a group of pagans, but even they can perceive that there is a power at work that the human eye cannot see. This can't just be dumb luck. The sequence of events is too perfect to be explained away, and they don't know it. But what they are seeing is the hidden hand of God, because God is sovereign over the sequences of our lives. God is sovereign over the sequences of our lives. And when we think he is late, he is right on schedule. When we think he has forgotten, he is remembering the smallest details. And in the middle of the story, it rarely makes any sense. I've been thinking this weekend about Mordecai, right? And putting myself in his position, knowing what he knows and what he doesn't know. What is he thinking as he's being paraded around on the king's horse? He's probably thinking, what good does this do? What good does this silly parade do me? Haman still hates me. There's a royal decree that says all the Jews can be killed. I don't need to be patronized right now. I need real salvation. And he has no idea that his life has just been saved. That God had used the king's insomnia and Haman's pride to deliver him from death that day. And it makes me wonder how often I have no idea what God has saved me from. Right? Just all the events in my life that don't make any sense and maybe never will. But there's so much going on behind the scenes that I don't see, but God does. And as we go through the problems of this earthly life, we have all sorts of strong opinions of what we think we need from God, don't we? Right? And we pray and we tell him that he needs to do this, and we tell him when he needs to do it. And one lesson I'm impressed with from the book of Esther is that God's plan of salvation is better than my own. God's plan of deliverance, his plan of redemption, his plan for justice and retribution is better than mine. And there's no greater evidence for that than the message of the gospel. God has had a better plan of salvation from before the foundation of the world. In his sovereignty, he planned for himself, for Jesus, to leave his throne in heaven and come on a rescue mission to earth. When we didn't just need to be delivered from an evil villain, we needed to be delivered from evil itself. So Jesus lived the perfect life that we failed to live. And then, in the ultimate sovereign sequence, Jesus died the death that we deserved to die. He was betrayed, arrested, illegally tried, brutally beaten, cruelly hung on a cross to pay the price for my sin and the price for your sin. He rose from the dead. He conquered sin and the grave. So if you place your faith in the perfect life, sacrificial death, and victorious resurrection of Jesus, no matter what you have done, all of your sins are forgiven. The righteousness of Jesus is credited to your account. You become part of the eternal family of God because God's plan of salvation and redemption and justice is better than ours. He sees the whole story while we only see the confusion of today. He is sovereign over the sequences of our lives. He knows what we need before we even say a word. He's a good father that is perfect in all of his ways to us. Let me pray, and Bob's going to come and sing about that truth. King Jesus, we just want to humble ourselves before you right now. And we need to acknowledge that you know better than us. We need to acknowledge that just because we can't see the whole picture doesn't mean that you can't. Just because we don't understand doesn't mean that you don't. I'm so thankful for all the times that you have delivered us without us even realizing it. I'm so thankful that your plan of salvation and redemption and deliverance and justice and retribution is so much better than our own. And so I pray that we would trust your sovereignty in the sequences. I pray that we would see your hand at work in the order of events that you have laid out for our lives. Give us the faith to trust you, to trust that you are a good father and that you are perfect in all of your ways to us, even when we don't understand. I pray this in Jesus' name.